Okay, so we are now approaching the very the end of the Satipatthana Sutta. First of all, we have the last of the four areas of contemplation, which is the area of mind objects, or perhaps of principles, or something to that effect. So this is the last one there. And because it is the last one, it is like the most refined one. This is the very last thing you do before you start entering the stages of samadhi and of the deep pieces of the mind. So we're now coming very close to samadhi, and we'll see how this kind of merges, the end of the Satipatthana Sutta kind of merges over into samadhi. It's a kind of a gradual movement from the very last hindrances into the kind of stages of mind, which are, the blisses of samadhi. It's a gradual movement going on there. So let us see what this is and how this works. And maybe before we go on to that, actually, I should maybe say that tradition, in the Satipatthana Sutta, as it's found in the Pali Canon, you find that there are five areas where you do this Dhammanupassana, the contemplation of mind objects. And the five areas are traditionally, you have the five hindrances, you have the six sense spheres, you have the seven bhujangas, you have the five aggregates, and then you have the Four Noble Truths. And you will see the headings are all in there. I left the headings in. But again, if you again do this comparison with other versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, you find that the two core aspects that you find everywhere pretty much is the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. That seems to be the core part of this particular contemplation. So again, that is interesting because it shows you the focus here is on developing those mind states, right, that take you to samadhi. That's the core focus in Satipatthana also at this point. So let's see how the contemplation of the five hindrances works. This is how it goes. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating or observing mind objects as mind objects or principles as principles? Here, bhikkhu abides contemplating mind stay or mind qualities as mind qualities in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind qualities? Sorry, I should say certain mind qualities. That has been my translation throughout. So how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating certain mind qualities in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. He also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So you can see here, this is all about how to deal with these things, right? How to understand them, how to deal with them, how to make sure that they don't arise again in the future. This is what this is really all about. And this involves causality. It involves understanding how something doesn't arise. Means understanding the causes for this, right? What are the causes for the arising of these things? And then by abandoning those causes, you're abandoning the arising of the thing itself. So this is what this is all about. So first of all, you understand that there is a sensual desire, right? You understand it again, as I said before, the full scope of these things. All the different qualities, the five different senses, the different strengths, the different variables. You have the full understanding of this, what it actually means. And you need that. You need to have a full understanding in order to be able to fully deal with it and fully abandon it. And that already takes quite a lot of insight to understand these things fully in all its variations. And then you also understand when it is fully, when it's not there, right? There is no sensual desire in me. You understand that. And in fact, it is at that point when you have when there's absolutely no sensual desire, when you've gone completely beyond that, after you emerge from a state of jhana, for example, there is no sensual desire there, then it's only then that you really can be absolutely sure that you have understood fully what sensual desire is all about. Right? Because when there's nothing there, then you can see the contrast. And then you can understand what this hindrance is all about fully when you have kind of gone beyond it. So this is the this is what it is. Remember, sensual desire is very broad, right? It refers to everything in the five senses. And then there comes the more conditional, the conditionality that is involved here. He also understands how there comes to be arisen, the arising, rather, of the unarisen sensual desire. What is it that brings this about, right? You know, in other words, this is where conditionality comes into things. Why is it that sensual desire arises? Right? You can see this in your meditation, and when you see it in a meditation, it becomes very powerful. That's really the way. But the Buddha also explains elsewhere why these things happen. Why is it that the craving for sensual pleasures actually arises? And it's always seeing the beauty in something, right? When you see the beauty in certain objects and you find it attractive, that is when the craving and the desire arises for that object. And we have just seen before, at the very beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, we saw how to deal with especially seeing the beauty in the body, right? That was one of the factors there. And how you deal with that is that you kind of see the other side of the body, so you neutralize that that aspect. So when you see a sensual desire arising or you see the potential for it arising, then you can use that perception that you have given rise to, the asubha sanya, the perception of the non-beautiful that you have developed at the beginning of the Satipatthana practice. And then you use that, and then you can abandon it quickly. Or there are other aspects of sensual desire that arise, whatever they might be. You can always use a counteractive perception that tells you not to go in that direction. So remember, here we're talking about very refined mind states, right? You're doing really well. You're approaching samadhi very, very quickly here. This is not something you do at the very early stages of the path. This is towards the very end, as you're coming close to the mind being fully unified. This is where this happens. And that is where you have the power to do these things, because the mind is already quite pure, or very pure even, at this particular stage. Okay, so you understand how there is the arising of the unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, right? The abandoning, again, it's about shifting your focus, looking at something else, or looking at the particular object that you have in a different way. We're talking about this before in terms of anger, and exactly the same thing works in terms of sensual desire. You remember the body, you remember the aspects of the body that are not beautiful as you normally look upon it. And then the last one is how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. And again, you understand, you have the understanding of causality, and you understand that if you want to abandon these things fully, you have to find happiness somewhere else. As long as you don't find that happiness somewhere else, the mind will search for happiness in the area of sensual pleasures. The Buddha says this elsewhere. He says that in one of the earlier suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya 14, I think. As long as you haven't achieved higher happiness, he says, the mind will always return to the sensual realm. In Majjhima Nikaya 14, the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, or the Chuladukkha Kanda Sutta, the shorter sutta on the mass of suffering here. So you understand, if you go to samadhi, if you go to that place where there is a higher happiness, then the happiness of sensuality will no longer tempt you, because you have something higher. And you understand, not only have you got something higher, but you understand that sensuality will actually hinder you from achieving samadhi. Because sensuality is about craving, right? It's about the future. It's not about staying in the present moment. So you see both of those two things, and then you know how this does not come about, how the non-arising comes about in the future, by developing the higher kinds of happiness. So here you are. So this is, again, remember, this is very refined things. This is very kind of towards the very last stages of the Buddhist path now. For many of you, you know, you may not have to worry too much about this. And again, it's more important to first of all, at the very least, in the early stages of the path, to get rid of any ill will. And that, of course, is the second factor here of the five hindrances. And that is much more important because it is much more painful, much more difficult, much more of an obstacle, and basically it is much more problem all over on the path, in life, and everything else. Let us therefore quickly look at the ill will. We have dealt with it quite a lot already, so we can probably just summarize some of those points now. So it's exactly the same thing as we just saw for sensual desire, the same principle. And here, there being ill will in him, the bhikkhu understands there is ill will in me. And there being no ill will in him, he understands there is no ill will in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen ill will, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen ill will, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. So again, same principle, right? You understand the full scope of what ill will means on the Buddhist path. And then you understand when there is no ill will in you. And it's the point when there is no ill will, no anger, nothing at all. Again, after a samadhi attainment, again, the same as with sensual desire, it's only then that you have the full understanding of what that means, because you have gone beyond, completely beyond these things. As with sensual desire, you understand the conditionality. We looked at the conditionality before, but again, what is it that gives rise to any kind of ill will or negativity or irritation or any of these negative things? And it's always seeing that in something which is kind of repulsive or not nice or not good in something else. That is what gives rise to the negative mind states. Not just repulsive, but that which you feel is patiga is the Pali word. Patiga is sometimes translated as something. Basically, means something that you find repulsive in a certain sense. So when something is not nice, that is when ill will tends to arise. So again, it is the same thing with people. You know, you have a perception of somebody you don't like. That is repulsive in a certain way, and then you shift your focus away from that. Again, exactly the same thing as we were talking about before, shifting your focus onto the good qualities instead, either in that object or in some other object. So here you're really learning how to deal with the mind, right? In a very kind of refined way. You do this inside the meditation practice as these things arise. You do it outside of meditation practice anytime you have enough mindfulness to be aware of what is going on. And there comes to be the abandoning of arisen ill will. Again, it's about shifting your perception away from that. And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. And again, that is usually through samadhi practice, where ill will is no longer really possible. So those are the two first hindrances. And as I said before, these are by far the most important ones. Here we are coming to the most refined aspects of those two hindrances, but still, this is really where I think most of the focus should be. And you can see that, I don't know if you have noticed that, but as we have gone through and looked at the path so far, looked at the four right efforts and all that, it tends to revolve around these two hindrances, right? Sense restraint is about desire and aversion, avoiding that. And many of the suttas talk about how to overcome these things in detail. And that's very interesting, and that means that these are the two core issues, and the other aspects of the five hindrances tend to follow along. If you have ill will, you have tiredness very often. If you have sensual craving, you will have restlessness as a consequence of that. So the other hindrances more or less follow along with the first two ones. So the first two ones is where the main emphasis is. But because we are now getting very close to samadhi, and because we are trying to get rid of all the defilements, even the most refined ones, at this stage, also the other three of the five hindrances actually become important. And the reason for that is because the first two hindrances, even though usually they are the ones that cause the other three, In certain respects, the other three, as you move towards samadhi, they also have a little bit of that, of a life of their own, and not being caused by the other ones. And the reason for that is because, remember, here we are moving towards states that are very unusual, states that are very threatening. They can feel very threatening. Those of you who have been coming close to these things, you will sometimes have noticed, you know, that you become fearful or you become excited, right? And because this is very powerful things. So it's like, oh, I'm not sure if I can take this. And because of that, the mind becomes restless. Fear is kind of a type of restlessness, right? It's like, whoa, what's going on? You are restless about this. The mind becomes agitated, which is a kind of restlessness. Or sometimes, if something is fearful, sometimes the mind decides to go into sloth and torpor. It wants to just shut it all down. You don't want to see what's going on anymore. And sometimes, as the mind becomes peaceful, sometimes it swaps into sloth and torpor instead. This is something you can also find on the path. And doubt can arise, you know, is this good? Is this dangerous? What is going on at this stage? So for that reason, at this stage of the path, when we are coming very close to the very lofty states of samadhi, all of these hindrances have to be dealt with in a certain way. Often is a sense of self that is kind of being challenged, right? You have to give up things that you're not used to give up. That is why fear arises. So here, all of these hindrances have to be dealt with to some extent. And sometimes it's just a matter of getting used to these states, used to these things, and then these things often fall away. So there is like a hierarchy here in the hindrances. This is what I'm trying to get to, I suppose. There's a hierarchy whereby the worst, the most significant one comes first, and then the importance of the five hindrances kind of get less and less as we go down. So the next one is called here sloth and torpor. It could be called tiredness and lethargy, maybe slightly more modern translation. Basically, you know, the tiredness of the mind. And exactly the same thing again. So there being tiredness and lethargy in him, he understands there is tiredness and lethargy in me. Well, there being no tiredness and lethargy in him, he understands there is no tiredness and lethargy in me. And he understands how there comes to be the rising of this tiredness and lethargy, how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen tiredness and lethargy, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of tiredness and lethargy. So same thing again. You understand what's going on. You understand this hindrance. You understand it in its different qualities, and you understand what causes it. And here it is quite subtle, and it's not so easy to actually maybe give a definitive answer on what actually causes this. Here, really, you have to rely on your own insight, because there can be many things, I think, that causes this kind of tiredness there. You choose a wrong path. Instead of moving towards the brightness of the mind, you move towards tiredness for whatever reason. So you have to investigate these things for yourself at this stage. But it's basically how you use your mind. It's how you focus. That is always the problem. So you're focusing on the wrong thing, or you're focusing in the wrong way, and that gives rise to these things. There is some kind of fear, some kind of worry, some perception of being challenged by something or something like that is happening here. So that is why this arises. And then you understand, by not focusing on that, this doesn't arise. And by entering samadhi, by entering those states where these things are kind of, often the term suppressed is used, which is not really a good term, but where these things are abandoned. And they are abandoned through the force of that samadhi. The power of the mind makes sure that these hindrances are kept at bay. They cannot arise anymore. That is kind of the idea. And the power of samadhi, that it kind of keeps these things at bay. They cannot arise in the presence of that powerful mind state. So that is tiredness and lethargy. These are, as I said, coming down the list, they are less and less important. And we have restlessness and remorse. And a similar kind of thing. You understand restlessness and remorse again. Understand what it is, you know when it's not present, and that is especially then that you can understand fully what it is. You understand why it arises, right? What are the things that cause it to arise? And again, it's how you reflect on something. If you see something as being fearful, then agitation can arise as a consequence. And that is an aspect of restlessness. This can come at this stage of the path in particular, because you have to give up so much of the stuff that you're used to, right? You're kind of entering an entirely new world, leaving behind all of your kind of bearings. You have no bearings anymore. What am I supposed to hold on to? Who am I? All these questions start to arise at this stage. And that is why fear, agitation, restlessness can easily arise. And then there is the remorse aspect of this. And this remorse is almost like this is kind of, you know, things that kind of darken your mind because you're not happy with your conduct and that sort of stuff. And sometimes you get people that come to this stage and they feel, I'm not worthy of this. It's too much happiness. You know, I don't deserve this kind of happiness. And that may also be perhaps an aspect of that remorse. You feel you haven't done well enough. You don't deserve these kind of marvelous states. So again, this is the sort of thing that can arise at this particular stage. And then you understand again that by entering samadhi, by these things being completely abandoned, not suppressed, because it's not really a suppression, but actually they are abandoned from the mind and they are held and they cannot arise because of the power of the brightness of the mind. And the last one is doubt. You know what doubt is. And doubt, what exactly is meant by doubt? And doubt here means specifically doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. That is specifically what it means. And so you don't really understand yet how the mind works, right? Where you're supposed to go, what are the more wholesome states, what are the unwholesome states? Especially perhaps when it comes to insight, you don't understand what is good and what is bad. So it is about understanding the mind, and it is by investigating that is how you overcome this doubt. By investigating, by feeling your way through this, knowing what is wholesome, knowing what is good, understanding what is bad, discriminating between these, that is how you overcome that doubt eventually. You're moving, making sure you're moving in the right direction here. And again, you know how the doubt arises. Doubt arises again by applying your mind in the wrong way, by investigating in the wrong way, thinking in the wrong way. And again, it does not arise by thinking in the right way. So again, I think this is something you have to gradually, you will uncover this for yourself as you get to this point. And again, the thing which completely demolishes the doubt is the samadhi. So the deep state of samadhi, where you know that this is an absolutely wholesome state. There are no defilements. And because you know, have a direct experience of what is absolutely wholesome, you have no doubt at that point that what is wholesome and what is unwholesome on the path. This is definitely wholesome. This is one of the knowledges you have when you enter a deep state of samadhi. The doubt has disappeared at that point. So this is the five hindrances for you, and this is roughly how to deal with them. So there is a lot of learning about these things, right? And there's a lot of insight in a sense here, but the insight in the sense of understanding these things. And as you understand them, more samatha and more vipassana arises as a consequence. More clear seeing and more calm comes as a consequence of that. And a lot of this just happens, right? You are there, you sit there, you are noticing these things, you have a clarity of what's going on. So you see this causality. You don't have to think. This is not a thinking process. It's more a process of seeing. You just see what's happening in your mind, because your mind is becoming very powerful at this stage, because it's becoming very still, right? You can imagine if you have a samadhi nimitta or whatever, or even if you're just fully focused on the breath, there's a lot of happiness there. The mind is very clear and very bright, and you can see small changes quite clearly here, and you can see why they arise. You can see causality, see how sequences work. So this is not a matter of thinking about things, it's just a matter of observing, and you can see these things directly for yourself as it happens. So please don't kind of make this into some kind of something which is very complicated. It's not really very complicated. It's just that when we talk about it, it sounds a bit complex, but it all kind of comes out in your meditation when you have the awareness. And then when you come out of the meditation afterwards, and this is, you may have noticed, every time I do the guided meditation, I say, and this is something I learned from Ajahn Brahm, I think it's a very useful tool, the idea that you reflect back on what happened, right? That is the time to reflect back. And because at that stage you have a very clear memory of what happened in your meditation, and because all of that has a very strong impact on you, you can actually then, you can remember the causality, you can see the process, you can see what happened, you can understand the development of the meditation. So it's always very useful to reflect a little bit every time. Sometimes you won't really kind of know, you won't really see very much, you won't be very clear what has happened, but other times it will be very clear to you what is going on, what works, what doesn't work. And this is how you build up that understanding of the whole process of moving towards peace and moving towards seeing things clearly here. So it actually, the practice of this is much simpler than it may seem here. So this is why this is about Dhammanupassana principles, right? Principles of causality, you can say. This is what this is the main thing that is happening here. So, and again, you have this idea of internal, external, and both internal and external. So you understand that this, obviously you see directly that this relates to you, and then you understand that this must relate to others as well. And then you, eventually, you get the insight, understand that this relates to all beings everywhere. This is not something that you can get away from, this movement of the mind and the different hindrances arising and passing away according to the laws of causality. This is a universal thing, right? Happens everywhere. It's not something that is specific to anybody's, any one person. Okay, so that is the five hindrances for you. And so the five, it's interesting that the five hindrances, often we talk about these in very general terms as if, they are something we can contemplate all along the path, but actually the five hindrances is something you do at the very end of the path. They are the very last vestiges, the very last remains of these mental states, of these defilements in the mind. So only at the very end, at the very last remains, only there do we actually call them the five hindrances. And they always occur in the gradual training, just before you enter samadhi, just before you enter the jhanas. That is why you have the five hindrances. So that's why in the suttas they're often called upakilesa. And the word upakilesa means like the refined kilesas, the refined defilements of the mind. That's what they actually refer to. So this is what the five hindrances are, which is quite, it's a bit unusual to think of them like that, because we think of them as a general blockages, but actually the way they are used is only at the very end of the path. Okay, then in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Pali, then comes the five aggregates, the contemplation of that. Then we have the six sense bases, and both of these I'm going to leave out. Especially the five aggregates only occurs in the Pali version and nowhere else. The six sense bases occurs in a few more places, but not so much. And perhaps you think, it's a bit strange, shouldn't this be part of Satipatthana, the five aggregates? Isn't this kind of a very important part of contemplation, understanding the nature of reality? And the answer, of course, is yes, it is a very important part of that. But the point is whether it really is part of Satipatthana practice, right? It's an important part of contemplation, important part of how we understand the world. But the question here is it part of Satipatthana or not? Satipatthana is the practice that leads towards samadhi. And then after samadhi, that's usually the time when you contemplate the five aggregates. So this is all about doing the right thing at the right time. This is what this is all about. Here we are still purifying the mind. Then you get to the samadhi. Then you have the chance to kind of reach awakening and these profound states. And that is where contemplation of the five aggregates or the four noble truths, that's where that comes to its fore. So now we come to the seven awakening factors, the satta sambojanga. And these are very lofty states of mind we come into now. These are the seven factors of awakening, are the seven factors that literally lead to awakening. That's what they call the seven factors of awakening here. These are the things, the final things that take you to full awakening, right? So now we are getting really, really up there. We're kind of moving to the very highest realms of the Buddhist path. So this is both exciting, but also very lofty and very far, really far on the path. And there is a very close relationship between the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana, and the satta sambhujanga, the seven factors of awakening. There's a close relationship because as the hindrances die down, the awakening factors become more powerful. There's an inverse relationship between the two. The hindrances become less and less should we go down, down, and the awakening factors become more, right? And there comes a point when the hindrances are completely abandoned, and that's when the awakening factors really, really become stronger. And you continue developing the mind in the awakening factors after the hindrances have gone completely. So it's not enough sometimes just to get rid of the hindrances. You have to continue to develop the mind in even more powerful states beyond abandoning the hindrances. There's a continuation of development even beyond that, right? So when the hindrances are all gone, it already feels very nice. It's very, very nice not to have these tyrants running your life. But then you can still go much further than that afterwards. So the path really continues. And this is what the seven awakening factors are about, this continuation of developing the mind. And these awakening factors are contemplated and they are regarded in exactly the same way as the five hindrances, in exactly the same terms. We understand them. You understand the causality that brings them into being or does not bring them into being. So this is how it goes. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating aspects of mind objects, certain aspects among the mind objects, in terms of the seven awakening factors. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating certain aspects of the mind objects in terms of the seven awakening factors? Here, there being the mindfulness awakening factor in him, a bhikkhu understands there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. Or there being no awakening mindfulness factor in him, he understands there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor, or how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor comes to fulfillment. That is a mistake here. Comes to fulfillment by development. So here again, the mindfulness awakening factor. Perhaps first of all, what is that? And it basically is just what we have seen before, the satipatthanas, especially the satipatthanas as we come towards the end of that practice, when the mind becomes very, very pure. So that's basically all it is. It is the satipatthana practice, the presence of the mind, right? Strongly present, very few defilements there. That is one thing. That is probably the main meaning of this term. Another meaning is just contemplation. This is also found in the suttas, contemplation of the suttas, right? To contemplate the Dhamma. And that is also a way of giving rise to the mindfulness awakening factor. And I think in broader terms, anything, any contemplation, any anusati, any recollection that gives rise to the following sequence of an awakening factors, and that can be recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, all of these things in a broader sense can be regarded as awakening factors. They're not defined as this in the suttas, but because they allow these awakening factors to grow and to come into existence, I think it is reasonable to assume that. So any recollection, any sati, any memory that brings these things into being is part of that. So again, there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. So you are aware, you know, when the mind has that state that is truly mindful, where there is clear comprehension, where you're able to guide the mind in the right direction, you have enough present moment awareness, you understand what that means, right? We've been talking about this before. Here it is perhaps that to a slightly higher extent. You understand when it's not present in you, and you understand how it comes to be. Why is it that this mindfulness factor of enlightenment comes to be? And this is what we have been looking at all the time, right? Why these things come to be? They come to be by the shedding of the defilements, by the abandoning of the defilements of the mind, in particular ill will and sensual desire. These are the things that stop the mindfulness from arising. So this is how you give rise to the mindfulness factor of awakening. Gradually, gradually, gradually reducing the defilements of the mind. And the more you reduce that, the more powerful that mindfulness factor of awakening becomes. And this is how you fulfill it by development, by continuing to abandon defilements more and more. And you will see that. You will see that every time you sit down to meditate and you feel that the mindfulness is becoming more powerful. Every time you can see that this awakening factor is rising, kind of growing inside of you, right? And it's very powerful and very pleasant and delightful state of mind when that happens. And then the awakening factors themselves, they are in a little bit the same as the Noble Eightfold Path, in that one awakening factor tends to lead to the next one. They kind of build up. So after the awakening factor of mindfulness, we have the awakening factor of investigation of qualities, Dhamma Vichaya Sambhujanga. And this, in the suttas, is defined as, again, understanding what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, understanding what is dark and what is bright, understand what is blameworthy and not blameworthy. So it is very similar to what we have just seen with the hindrances, right? Very similar to what we're doing here, basically. Is that you are investigating what are positive and what are bad qualities in your meditation practice. And the more you are able to differentiate these things and pull them apart, understand how they work, etc., that is how you investigate dhammas. So this, again, we are here. This is very overlaps very much with the final part, what we're looking at now, of the of Satipatthana itself, right? So the Sambhujangas and the Satipatthanas kind of overlap at this stage and become almost the same thing. You can't really pull them apart anymore. They are basically the same thing happening here, especially since the Bhujangas themselves are part of Satipatthana. And so you do the same thing. How does this arise? Well, because the awakening factors are sequential, because one gives rise to the other one, it is your mindfulness that gives rise to the ability to discern these things. Once you are mindful, you start to have the ability to discern, distinguish between good and bad qualities of mind. And then the second factor, the third factor rather, is energy, right? Should be energy. So then they have the energy factor coming. And this is one of those interesting things that you see in the suttas, that this idea, mindfulness, energy, and rapture, rapture being the piti, right, or the pamuja, these are three states that always work around each other. If you have strong mindfulness, you tend to have energy, and it tends to be rapture present. If there is energy, you tend to be mindful, and rapture tends to be there. So these are often, you find different sequences of these things. So for example, if you go to the five spiritual faculties, there it is, first of all, energy and then mindfulness. But here it is the other way around, mindfulness and energy, right? And then piti is always in there, even the lower happiness, or pamuja, is always also in there somehow, in that kind of blend. So these are very closely related to each other. The idea of just feeling really glad, feeling happy, having an energetic and bright mind, and having mindfulness. It's almost as if these are different aspects of the same thing, right? Mindfulness, rapture, and energy all coming together. And it's a very nice mix, right? You can almost feel this. You know, the feeling happiness in the present moment, having energy there. You can see why this almost always must go together. And then because you're happy and feeling energetic, you obviously you're present as well, right? You can see how these things are aspects of the same thing. Yeah? Whenever you have a positive meditation experience, you will see that in your own life, how these things are part and parcel of the same quality, really. Yeah? It's quite obvious why that must be the case. So you have the energy starts to arise. Why does it arise? Because now you are abandoning all the dark aspects of the mind, right? There's less, at this point, there's almost no defilements left in the mind. And what taps the energy of the mind are the defilements. That is what makes the mind not be energetic. You know, this sensual desire tires you out, as does ill will. You can just notice this for yourself, why that is the case. The craving, the running after things, that restlessness, the agitation which comes with that, all of that tires you out. And when these die down, the energy of the mind arises by itself. And that is why you get energetic at this stage, because the defilements are falling away. Energy comes to its force, right? And you can see why. The cause is because the defilements are being abandoned. Again, all of these things, you understand them for what they are by investigating it. You know them when they're not present, when they're present, and you understand the causality. This is what is going through this whole sequence here. And then, because you have energy, you have rapture, piti. Piti arises as a consequence. Sometimes it's very strong feelings of bliss almost going through your body and also in your mind. And again, you understand what that is. You know it by feeling it. Sometimes, again, once you go beyond it, that's when you really know what rapture is, because it's possible to go beyond rapture as well. Every time you go beyond something is when you really understand what it was. And then you understand what causes it. What causes rapture here is energy. First you feel energetic. It's a kind of lower type of happiness. Then you develop that further, and it gives rise to a very powerful sense of rapture. This is, of course, now you can see here also a very strong parallelism to the very first sutta we did. Remember the first sutta we started off with, saying that you have sila, from sila comes non-regret, comes pamuja, the gladness, pamuja comes piti, the rapture, piti comes tranquility, and then from that comes sukha and then samadhi. And it's exactly the same thing you're seeing here. See, all of these things tie together. It is very closely interwoven with each other, all of these suttas. And they just show you different angles to all of these things. So the piti, joy, very strong joy arises in the mind. And from that, you take that further, comes the tranquility, right? You understand when tranquility is there. You understand what is not there. You keep on investigating. You have clarity about what's going on. You spend a few minutes at the end of meditation thinking about these things, just to reflect, to make it solid what is going on. In this way, you solidify your practice, because you're always understanding what the states are, what the absence mean, how they come into being. And tranquility comes into being through rapture. Piti, as it strengthens, as you develop it further, eventually it goes into tranquility, an even higher state of happiness than the rapture itself. Then from tranquility comes samadhi here. So here we are skipping the state of sukha, because sukha is often inherent in tranquility. There's a happiness that comes with the tranquility. So here you go straight to samadhi. Tranquility, right? Everything becomes very peaceful, very calm. The present moment, incredibly beautiful. The mind becomes steadied in the present moment, and samadhi arises through that happiness that is there. Samadhi comes. This is the samadhi, sambhujanga, that arises. You know what it is through experience. You know what its absence means. You know how it arises through tranquility, through that deep pleasure, that deep happiness that comes as a consequence of that. And then the last awakening factor is the awakening factor of here, equanimity, upekkha. And this comes again after samadhi, the highest state on the Noble Eightfold Path, the fourth jhana, after you have abandoned all the happinesses, all the piti, all the sukhas and everything, and all that is left is just pure and neither pleasure nor pain. It's equanimity in the mind. And this is what is meant here by the awakening factor of equanimity. This is like the very end of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The very top, the fourth jhana. You come to the end of the practice and the path. So you know what that equanimity means. You know what its absence is. And you understand that it arises through samadhi. When you take the samadhi practice far enough, that is where that equanimity comes into existence. So these are the awakening factors. We've just seen that, and they arise once the defilements are abandoned. So again, it's all about investigating, being clear, just following these things in your meditation, seeing what they are, spending a bit of time after the meditation to contemplate what is happening here. It's all very exciting stuff, very kind of great things to look forward to on this path. But there's so many amazing things on this path. And the further along the path you come, and now we're going higher and higher on this path, the more amazing it all tends to become. So, and this is how the awakening factor of equanimity comes to fulfillment by development, right? You keep on practicing the same things. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects certain aspects of mind objects, internally, externally, both internally, externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating certain aspects of the mind objects in terms of the seven factors of awakening. And here you are really becoming independent, right? Here you are really not depending on anything. And you're not holding on to anything in the world. In fact, you are so happy that you have let go of pretty much the whole world. You have no interest in that worldly stuff anymore whatsoever at this point. And it's all fallen by the wayside. You have found something which is far, far more powerful and beautiful than anything in the world can ever give you. So that is great, right? You have exchanged the dukkha for sukha, and now you have let go of so much of that suffering and pain in life. So that is how, this is the, again, satipatthana, because it is about here investigating causality, understanding how these things come into existence. Okay, so I hope that makes a little bit of sense to you. And if there are things that I have spoken, if I have gone too fast or haven't been clear about anything, please, we can maybe try to express it on some questions this evening if you like. Now we come to the very, very final part of the Satipatthana Sutta. Before that, we have the Four Noble Truths. And again, that only occurs in the Pali version. And for that reason, I have left it out, because it seems to be not a core aspect of what Satipatthana is about. Then we have the conclusion. And again, I will read it out. The conclusion here too is not really a core aspect. It occurs only in some of those, some of the suttas. But still, it probably gives maybe some idea of how Satipatthana, how quickly it's supposed to give results. This is what this is about. Because if anyone should develop these four attendings of mindfulness, or four focuses of mindfulness, in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for him: either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning. Final knowledge here now is arahantship, full awakening, the abandoning of all suffering, the end of all rebirth, the end of all defilements. That's what final knowledge means. Anya is the Pali word for that. Here and now means in this life, right? That's what it means. Here in Ditteva Dhamma, in this very life. And if there is a trace of clinging left, then non-returning. Non-returning means that you get reborn in this incredibly blissful jhana world, and you just hang out there for a few eons, and then you, and then you, when you pass away from there, that is when you attain nibbana from there, straight from there. That sounds pretty good. It's good enough, right? So if you so you're happy with that. Okay. Then the Buddha says, well, let alone 7 years, because if anyone should develop these four focuses on mindfulness in such a way for 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, or for 1 year, one of two fruits can be expected, final knowledge or non-returning. Let alone 1 year, because if one should develop these four focuses of mindfulness in such a way for 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, for half a month, one of two fruits should be expected for him, either final knowledge or non-returning. Let alone half a month, because if one should develop these four aspects for focus of mindfulness in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits should be expected for him, final knowledge here and now, or non-returning. So, again, as I said, this is not a core aspect of Satipatthana, and it varies a lot from tradition to tradition, so it's not something we really need to take into account that much. But I think the point here is that the Buddha said at the beginning, this is the path, right, which leads in one direction only. It leads to Nibbana eventually. So if you keep on practicing it, you will eventually get there. Sometimes it can happen quite fast, in 7 days. So how can it happen in 7 days? And why is it for some people it takes 7 years? What's the difference? The difference is just how far you have gone in your practice. So if you already have the jhanas, well, then it's going to happen very fast. If you have the fourth jhana already, it can happen straight away, pretty much. But if you are kind of still struggling with defilements to some extent, well, then of course it's going to take much longer. So it all depends on where you are on that path. But once you have that mindfulness established, right, so that you can actually do the satipatthanas, then you are so much on the right track that if you practice this properly, then 7 years, it says here, is the most it should take. Probably meant as a ballpark figure. I don't know how you can exactly say 7 years, right? It's a bit kind of... Okay, and then he finishes off by repeating what he said at the beginning. So it was with reference to this that it was said, bhikkhus, this is the direct path, or the path that leads in one direction only, for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way. The true way is the seeing of the Noble Eightfold Path for yourself, for the realization of Nibbana, of extinguishment, namely the four focuses of mindfulness. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, so that is the Satipatthana Sutta for you. And I thought it would be nice to do it because it is a sutta which people talk about so much. And for that reason, I think it's quite useful to go through that. So there you are. And remember, just to summarize what Satipatthana is all about. It's all about purifying yourself, understanding, taking the purification from the point where you have a reasonable mindfulness, you have a reasonable, clear comprehension. The clear comprehension is really the right view. You understand what you're supposed to do, right? Abandon defilements, purify the mind. That guides you in your practice. That's why it's called clear comprehension, because it guides you. You're not just mindful and just kind of whatever, but you have mindful in a certain way, so it leads in the right direction. And that is the beginning of Satipatthana. And then the whole process, as we have seen throughout this, is about understanding defilements, understanding problems in the mind, understanding causality that leads to these problems, and then gradually getting rid of those and moving towards more and more purity and brightness and developing all the good states at the same time. This is what Satipatthana is. And because that is what it is, it leads you inexorably, whether you want to or not, it leads you to samadhi, right? It leads you to that enormous purity and stillness of the mind that comes as a consequence of that. The mind becomes unified and you get to samadhi as a consequence. So we will soon have a look at all those samadhi states as well. This is very lofty, and some of you may occasionally have kind of little glimpses of these states. But even so, it is nice to know about these things, to know what this path really, where it really is heading. It's very inspiring to know that. But before we do that, tomorrow we will be looking at the Anapanasati Sutta, which comes next, and which is a very nice way of also of summarizing the focuses of mindfulness. So that is tomorrow morning, and apart from that, we will see you again this evening. Thank you.